"If we can," Tengo repeated mentally. It had a prophetic sound. "Are you thinking we might not be able to?" Tengo asked with some hesitation. Fukaeri did not reply. "Assuming we can, we'll meet him. Are you okay with that?"
"Meet him and do what?"
"Meet him and do what? Well, first I'd return some money to him. A fairly good-sized payment was transferred into my bank account the other day for my rewriting of Air Chrysalis, but I'd rather not take it. Not that I have any regrets about having done the work. It was a great inspiration for my own writing, and guided me in a good direction. And it turned out pretty well, if I do say so myself. It's been well received critically, and the book is selling. I don't believe it was a mistake for me to take it on. I just never expected it to blow up like this. Of course, I am the one who agreed to do it, and I certainly have to take responsibility for that. But I just don't want to be paid for it." Fukaeri gave her shoulders a little shrug. Tengo said, "You're right. It might not change a thing, but I'd like to make it clear where I stand."
"Who for?"
"Well, mainly for myself," Tengo said, lowering his voice somewhat. Fukaeri picked up the lid of the jam jar and stared at it as if she found it fascinating. "But it may already be too late," Tengo said. Fukaeri had nothing to say to that. When Tengo tried phoning Komatsu's office after 1 o'clock, Komatsu never came to work in the morning. The woman who answered said that Komatsu had not been in for the past several days. That was all she knew. Or, if she knew more, she obviously had no intention of sharing it with Tengo. He asked her to connect him with another editor he knew. Tengo had written short columns under a pseudonym for the monthly magazine edited by this man, who was 2 or 3 years older than Tengo and generally well-disposed toward him, in part because they had graduated from the same university. "Komatsu has been out for over a week now," the editor said. "He called in on the third day to say he wouldn't be coming to work for a while because he wasn't feeling well, and we haven't seen him since. The guys in the book division are going crazy. He's in charge of Air Chrysalis, and so far he's handled everything himself. He's supposed to restrict himself to the magazine side of things, but he ignored that fact and hasn't let anybody else lay a finger on this project, even when it went into book production. So if he takes off now, nobody knows what to do. If he's really sick, I suppose there's nothing we can say, but still..."
"What's wrong with him?"
"I don't know. All he said was he's not feeling well, and then he hung up. Haven't heard a word from him since. We wanted to ask him a few things and tried calling him, but all we got was the answering machine. Nobody knows what to do."
"Doesn't he have a family?"
"No, he lives alone. He used to have a wife and a kid, but I'm pretty sure he's been divorced for a long time. He doesn't tell anybody anything, so I don't really know, but that's what I've heard."
"Anyhow, it's strange that he's been out a week and you've only heard from him once."
"Well, you know Komatsu. Common sense isn't really his thing."
Receiver in hand, Tengo thought about this remark.
"It's true, you never know what he'll do next. He's socially awkward, and he can be self-centered. But as far as I know, he's not irresponsible about his work. I don't care how sick he is, he wouldn't just let everything go and not contact the office when Air Chrysalis is selling like this. He's not that bad."
"You're absolutely right," the editor said.
"Maybe somebody should go to his place and see what's up. There was all that trouble with Sakigake over Fukaeri's disappearance, and we still don't know where she is. Something might have happened. I can't believe he'd fake being sick so he could take off from work and hide out with Fukaeri, right?"
Tengo said nothing. He could hardly tell the man that Fukaeri was right there in front of him, cleaning her ears with a cotton swab.
"And not just this case, everything involving this book. I don't know, there's something wrong with it. We're glad it's selling so well, but there's something about it that's not quite right. And I'm not the only one. A lot of people at the company feel that way about it. Oh, by the way, Tengo, did you have something you wanted to talk to Komatsu about?"
"No, nothing special. I haven't talked to him for a while, so I was just wondering what he's up to."
"Maybe the stress of it all finally got to him. Anyhow, Air Chrysalis is the first bestseller this company has ever had. I'm looking forward to this year's bonus. Have you read the book?"
"Of course, I read the manuscript when it was submitted for the competition."
"Oh, that's right, you were a screener. I thought it was well written and pretty interesting, too."
"Oh, it's interesting, all right, and well worth a read."
Tengo detected an ominous ring to his remark. "But something about it bothers you?"
Well, this is just an editor's intuition. You're right, it is well written. A little too well written for a debut by a 17-year-old girl. And now she's disappeared, and we can't get in touch with her editor. The book is like one of those old ghost ships with nobody aboard. It just keeps sailing along, all sails set, straight down the bestseller seaway. Tengo managed a vague grunt. It's creepy, mysterious, too good to be true. This is just between you and me, but people around here are whispering that Komatsu himself might have fixed up the manuscript. More than common sense would allow. I can't believe it, but if it's true, we could be holding a time bomb. Maybe it was just a series of lucky coincidences. Even so, good luck can only last so long, the editor said. Tengo thanked him and ended the call. After hanging up, Tengo said to Fukaeri, Mr. Komatsu hasn't been to work for the past week. They can't get in touch with him. Fukaeri said nothing. The people around me seem to be disappearing one after another, Tengo said. Still, Fukaeri said nothing. Tengo suddenly recalled the fact that people lose 50 million skin cells every day. The cells get scraped off, turn into invisible dust, and disappear into the air. Maybe we are nothing but skin cells as far as the world is concerned. If so, there's nothing mysterious about somebody suddenly disappearing one day. I may be next, Tengo said. Fukaeri gave her head a tight little shake. Not you, she said. Why not me? Because I did a purification. Tengo contemplated this for several seconds without reaching a conclusion. He knew from the start that no amount of thinking could do any good. Still, he could not entirely forego the effort to think. In any case, we can't see Mr. Komatsu right now, Tengo said, and I can't give the money back to him. The money is no problem, Fukaeri said. Then what is a problem? Tengo asked. Of course, he did not receive an answer. Tengo decided to follow through on last night's resolution to search for Aomami. If he spent the whole day in a concentrated effort, he should at least be able to come up with some kind of clue. But in fact, it turned out not to be that easy. He left Fukaeri in his apartment, after warning her repeatedly not to open the door for anyone, and went to the telephone company's main office, which had a complete set of telephone books for every part of the country, available for public use. He went through all the phone books for Tokyo's 23 central wards, looking for the name Aomami. Even if he didn't find Aomami herself, a relative might be living there, and he could ask that person for news of Aomami. But he found no one with the name Aomami. He broadened his search to include the entire Tokyo metropolis, and still found no one. He further broadened his search to include the entire Kanto region, the prefectures of Chiba, Kanagawa, and Saitama. At that point, his time and energy ran out. After glaring at the phone book's tiny type all day, his eyeballs were aching. Several possibilities came to mind. One, she was living in a suburb of the city of Utashinai on Hokkaido. Two, she had married and changed her name to Ito. Three, she kept her number unlisted to protect her privacy. Four, she had died in the spring 2 years earlier from a virulent influenza. There must have been any number of possibilities besides these. It didn't make sense to rely strictly on the phone books, nor could he read every one in the country. It could be next month before he finally reached Hokkaido. He had to find another way. Tengo bought a telephone card and entered a booth at the telephone company. From there, he called their old elementary school in Ichikawa and asked the female office worker who answered the phone to look up the address they had on file for Aomami, saying he wanted to reach her on alumni association business. The woman seemed kind and unhurried as she went through the roster of graduates. Aomami had transferred to another school in the fifth grade and was not a graduate. Her name therefore did not appear in the roster, and they did not know her current address. It would be possible, however, to find the address to which she moved at the time. Did he want to know that? Tengo said he did want to know that. He took down the address and telephone number, care of Koji Tasaki, in Tokyo's Adachi Ward. Aomami had apparently left her parents' home at the time. Something must have happened. Figuring it was probably hopeless, Tengo tried dialing the phone number. As he had expected, the number was no longer in use. It had been 20 years, after all. He called information and gave them the address and the name Koji Tasaki, but learned only that no telephone was listed under that name. Next, Tengo tried finding the phone number for the headquarters of the Society of Witnesses, but no contacts were listed for them in any of the phone books he perused. Nothing under Before the Flood, nothing under Society of Witnesses, or anything else of that ilk. He tried the classified directory under Religious Organizations, but found nothing. At the end of this struggle, Tengo concluded that they probably didn't want anyone contacting them. This was, upon reflection, rather odd. They showed up all the time. They'd ring the bell or knock on the door, unconcerned that you might be otherwise occupied, be it baking a souffle, soldering a connection, washing your hair, training a mouse to do tricks, or thinking about quadratic functions, and with a big smile invite you to study the Bible with them. They had no problem coming to see you, but you were not free to go to see them, unless you were a believer, probably. You couldn't ask them one simple question. This was rather inconvenient. But even if he did manage to find the Society's phone number and get in touch with them, it was hard to imagine that such a wary organization would freely disclose information on an individual believer. No doubt they had their reasons for being so guarded. Many people hated them for their extreme, eccentric doctrines and for the close-minded nature of their faith. They had caused several social problems, as a result of which their treatment often bordered on persecution. It had probably become second nature for them to protect their community from a less-than-welcoming outside world. In any case, Tengo's search for Aomami had been shut down, at least for now. He could not immediately think of what additional search methods might remain. Aomami was such an unusual name, you could never forget it once you'd heard it. But in trying to trace the footsteps of one single human being who bore that name, he quickly collided with a hard wall. It might be quicker to go around asking Society of Witnesses members directly. Headquarters would probably doubt his motives and refuse to tell him anything. But if he were to ask some individual member, he felt they would probably be kind enough to tell him. But Tengo did not know even one member of the Society of Witnesses. Come to think of it, no one from the Society had knocked on his door for a good 10 years now. Why did they not come when you wanted them, and come only when you didn't want them? One possibility was to put a classified ad in the paper. Aomami, please contact me immediately. Kawana. Stupid sounding. Tengo couldn't believe that Aomami would bother to contact him even if she saw such an ad. It would probably just end up scaring her away. Kawana was not such a common name either, but Tengo couldn't believe that Aomami would still remember it. Kawana? Who's that? She simply wouldn't contact him. And besides, who read classified ads anyway? Another approach might be to hire a private detective. They should know how to look for people. They have their methods and connections. The clues Tengo already had might be enough for them to find her right away, and it probably wouldn't be too expensive. But that might be something to set aside as a last resort, Tengo thought. He would try a little harder to see what he could come up with himself. When the daylight began to fade, he went home to find Fukaeri sitting on the floor listening to records, old jazz records left by his girlfriend. Record jackets were spread on the floor, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, Billie Holiday. Spinning on the turntable just then was Louis Armstrong singing Chantez les Bas, a memorable song. It reminded him of his girlfriend. They had often listened to this one between bouts of lovemaking. Near the end, the trombonist, Trummy Young, gets carried away, forgets to end his solo at the agreed-upon point, and plays an extra 8 bars. Here, this is the part, his girlfriend had explained to him. When it ended, it was Tengo's job to get out of bed naked, go to the next room, and turn the LP over to play the second side. He felt a twinge of nostalgia recalling those days. Though he never thought the relationship would last forever, he had not expected it to end so abruptly. Tengo felt odd seeing Fukaeri listening intently to the records that Kyoko Yasuda had left behind. Wrinkling her brow in complete concentration, she seemed to be trying to hear something beyond the old music, straining to see the shadow of something in its tones. "You like this record?" "I listen to it a lot," Fukaeri said. "Is that okay?" "Sure it's okay," But aren't you bored here all by yourself? Fukaeri gave her head a little shake.
I have stuff to think about.
Tengo wanted to ask Fukaeri about what had happened between them during the thunderstorm. Why did you do that? He couldn't believe that Fukaeri had any sexual desire for him. It must have been an act that somehow took shape unconnected with sex. If so, what possible meaning could it have had? Even if he asked her about it outright, though, he doubted he would receive a straight answer. And Tengo couldn't quite bring himself to broach a subject like that directly on such a peaceful, quiet September evening. It was an act that had been performed in hiding, at a dark hour, in a dark place, in the midst of a raging thunderstorm. Brought out into everyday circumstances, the nature of its meaning might change. So Tengo approached the question from a different angle, one that admitted a simple yes or no answer. You don't have periods.
No,
was Fukaeri's curt reply. You've never had even one.
No, not even one.
This may be none of my business, but you're 17 years old. It's probably not normal that you've never had a period. Fukaeri gave a little shrug. Have you seen a doctor about it? Fukaeri shook her head.
It wouldn't do any good.
Why wouldn't it do any good? Fukaeri did not answer. She gave no sign that she had even heard the question. Maybe her ears had a special valve that sensed a question's appropriateness or inappropriateness, opening and closing as needed, like a mermaid's gills. Are the little people involved in this too? Tengo asked. Again, no answer. Tengo sighed. He couldn't think of anything else to ask that would enable him to approach a clarification of last night's events. The narrow, uncertain path gave out at that point, and only a deep forest lay ahead. He checked his footing, scanned his surroundings, and looked up to the heavens. This was always the problem with talking to Fukaeri. All roads inevitably gave out. A Gilyak might be able to continue on even after the road ended, but for Tengo it was impossible. Instead, he brought up a new subject. "I'm looking for a certain person," he said. "A woman." There was no point in talking about this to Fukaeri. Tengo was fully aware of that, but he wanted to talk about it to someone. He wanted to hear himself telling someone, anyone, what he was thinking about Aomami. Unless he did so, he felt Aomami would grow even more distant from him. "I haven't seen her for 20 years. I was 10 when I last saw her. She and I are the same age. We were in the same class in elementary school. I've tried different ways of finding her without any luck." The record ended. Fukaeri lifted it from the turntable, narrowed her eyes, and sniffed the vinyl a few times. Then, handling it carefully by the edges so as not to leave fingerprints on it, she slipped it into its paper envelope and slid the envelope into the record jacket, gently, lovingly, like transferring a sleeping kitten to its bed. "You want to see this person?" Fukaeri asked, without a question mark. "Yes, she is very important to me."
"Have you been looking for her for 20 years? Fukaeri asked.
"No, I haven't," Tengo said. While searching for the proper words to continue, Tengo folded his hands on the table. "To tell you the truth, I just started looking for her today."
"Today?" she said.
"If she's so important to you, why have you never looked for her until today?" Tengo asked for Fukaeri. "Good question." Fukaeri looked at him in silence. Tengo put his thoughts into some kind of order. Then he said, "I've probably been taking a long detour. This girl named Aomami has been, how should I put this, at the center of my consciousness all this time, without a break. She has functioned as an important anchor to my very existence. In spite of that fact, is it? I guess I haven't been able to fully grasp her significance to me, precisely because she has been all too close to the center." Fukaeri stared at Tengo. It was impossible to tell from her expression whether this young girl had the slightest comprehension of what he was saying. But that hardly mattered. Tengo was half talking to himself. "But it has finally hit me. She is neither a concept, nor a symbol, nor a metaphor. She actually exists. She has warm flesh and a spirit that moves. I never should have lost sight of that warmth and that movement. It took me 20 years to understand something so obvious. It always takes me a while to think of things, but this is a little too much. It may already be too late. But one way or another, I want to find her. With her knees on the floor, Fukaeri straightened up, the shape of her nipples showing through the Jeff Beck t-shirt. "Ah, oh, ma me," Fukaeri said slowly, as if pondering each syllable. "Yes, Green Peas. It's an unusual name." "You want to meet her?" Fukaeri asked, without a question mark. "Yes, of course I want to meet her," Tengo said. Fukaeri chewed her lower lip as she took a moment to think about something. Then she looked up as if she had hit upon a new idea, and said, "She might be very close by."
Chapter 17. Almame. Pull the Rat Out. The 7 a.m. television news carried a big report on the Akasaka Mitsuke subway station's flooding, but there was no mention of the death of Sakigake's leader in a suite at the Hotel Okura. When NHK's news ended, Almame switched channels and watched the news on a few other channels, but none of them announced that large man's painless death. "They hid his body," Almame thought, scowling. Tamaru had predicted such a possibility, but she had found it hard to believe that they would actually do it. Somehow, they had managed to carry Leader's corpse from the Hotel Okura suite, load it into a car, and take it away. He was a big man, and the corpse must have been tremendously heavy. The hotel was full of guests and employees. Security cameras were everywhere. How had they succeeded in carrying the corpse to the hotel's underground parking lot without having anyone notice? They must have transported the body at night to the headquarters in Yamanashi and then held a discussion of what to do with it. At least they were not going to formally report his death to the police. Once you've hidden something, you have to keep it hidden. Almame, of course, had no idea how they intended to fill the vacuum created by Leader's death. But they would exhaust every means available to them to maintain the organization. As the man himself had said, the system would endure with or without a leader. Who could inherit Leader's mantle? That problem had nothing to do with Almame. Her assignment had been to liquidate Leader, not to crush a religion. She thought about the two bodyguards in their dark suits, buzz cut and ponytail. When they got back to headquarters, would they be held responsible for having allowed Leader to be wiped out before their very eyes? Ah, Mama imagined their next assignment. Find that woman, no matter what. Don't come back here until you do. It was possible. She ate an apple for breakfast, but she had almost no appetite. Her hands still retained the sensation of driving the needle into the back of the man's neck. While peeling the apple with a small knife in her right hand, she felt a slight trembling in her body, a trembling she had never experienced before. When she had killed someone in the past, the memory of it had nearly faded after a night's sleep. Though it never felt good to take a person's life, those were all men who didn't deserve to go on living. They inspired more disgust than human pity. But this time was different. Objectively, what this man has been doing was perhaps an affront to humanity. But he himself was, in many senses, an extraordinary human being, and his extraordinariness, at least in part, appeared to transcend standards of good and evil. Ending his life had also been something extraordinary. It had left a strange kind of resonance in her hands. An extraordinary resonance. What he had left behind was a promise. This was the conclusion to which Almame's thoughts led her. The weight of that promise was left in her hands as a sign. She understood this. The sign might not fade from her hands. Ever. The phone rang shortly after 9 a.m. It was Tamaru. It rang three times, stopped, then started again 20 seconds later. they didn't call the police after all, Tamaru said. It's not on the TV news or in the paper. He did die, though. I'm sure of that. Yes, of course, I know. No question he died. There were a few movements around there. They've already cleared out of the hotel. They called in several people from their city branch office in the middle of the night, probably to help deal with the body. They're good at things like that. Around 1 a.m., an S-Class Mercedes and a Toyota Hiace van left the hotel parking lot. Both had dark glass and Yamanashi plates. They were probably back in Sakigake headquarters by sunrise. The police investigated the compound the day before yesterday, but it wasn't a full-scale operation, and all the officers were long gone by then. Sakigake has a big incinerator. If you threw a body in there, it wouldn't leave a bone, just clean smoke. Creepy. They're a creepy bunch, all right. Even if their leader is dead, the organization will keep moving for a while, like a snake that keeps going even after its head is cut off. Head on or off, it knows exactly where it's headed. Nobody can say what will happen in the future. It might die, or grow a new head. He was no ordinary man. Tamaru offered no opinion on that matter. Completely different from the others, Amame said. Tamaru took a moment to gauge the resonance of her words. Then he said, Yes, I can imagine this was different from the others. But we'd better start thinking about what happens from now on, and be a little more practical. Otherwise you won't be able to survive. Amame thought she should say something, but the words would not come. The trembling was still there in her body. Madame tells me she wants to talk to you, Tamaru said. Can you talk? Of course, Amame said. The dowager took the phone. Amame could sense relief in her voice. I am so grateful to you, more than I can ever say. You handled this one perfectly. Thank you very much. But I don't think I'll be able to do it again, Amame said. No, I realize that. We asked too much of you. I'm so happy you're all right. We won't be asking you to do this anymore. This was the last time. We have prepared a place for you to settle into. You won't have to worry about a thing. Just lie low for a while in the safe house. In the meantime, we'll make arrangements for you to move into your new life. Amame thanked her. Do you have everything you need there? If not, let us know. I'll have Tamaru take care of it right away. No, thank you. As far as I can tell, everything I need is here. The dowager lightly cleared her throat. Now, this is something I want you to keep in mind. What we did was absolutely right. We punished the man for his crimes and prevented him from committing any more. There will be no more victims. We put a stop to that. You must not let this bother you. He said the same thing. He? Sakigake's leader. The man I took care of last night. The dowager remained silent for a full 5 seconds. Then she said, He knew? Yes. He knew I was there to take care of him. And still he let me in. He was, if anything, hoping for death. His body had already suffered serious injury and was heading toward a slow but inevitable end. All I did was speed up the process somewhat and provide relief to a body tortured by intense pain. The dowager seemed seriously shocked to hear this. Again, she was at a loss for words, something most unusual for her. You mean to say, the dowager said, looking for the right words, that he himself was hoping for punishment for his deeds. What he wanted was to end his painful life as soon as possible. And he made up his mind to let you kill him. Exactly. Almame said nothing about the bargain she had struck with Leader. In exchange for letting Tengo go on living in this world, she herself would have to die. This was an agreement known only to Almame and the man. No one else was to be told. Almame said, "The things he did were deviant and deserving of death. But he was no ordinary human being. Or at least he possessed something special." "Something special?" the dowager said. "It's hard to explain," Almame said. "It was at the same time both a special power or gift and a cruel burden. It was, I think, eating him alive from the inside." "Could it be that this special something urged him on toward his deviant behavior?" "Probably. In any case, you put a stop to it." "That is true," Almame said, her voice dry. Holding the receiver in her left hand, Almame spread out her right hand with its lingering sensation of death and stared at the palm. What did it mean to have ambiguous congress with those girls? Almame could neither understand it nor explain it to the dowager. "As always, I made the death appear to have been a natural one, but they will probably not do us the favor of seeing it that way. Given the circumstances, I'm sure they will conclude that I had something to do with it. And as you know, his death has not been reported to the police yet. Whatever steps they choose to take, we will do everything in our power to protect you," the dowager said. "They have their organization, but we have strong connections and ample funds. Also, you are a careful, intelligent person. We won't let them have their way." "Have you not yet found Tsubasa?" Almame asked. "We still don't know where she went. My thought is that she is in the Sakigake compound. She has nowhere else to go. We haven't found a way to bring her back yet, but I suspect that Leader's death has put the group into a state of confusion. We may be able to do something to exploit that confusion in order to save her. That child must be protected." That child, in the safe house, was not actual substance, according to Leader. She was merely one form of a concept, and had since been retrieved. But Almame could hardly say this to the dowager now. Almame herself did not know what it meant. She did, however, remember the levitation of the marble clock. She had seen it happen with her own eyes. Almame asked, "How many days will I be hiding out in this safe house?" "You should assume it will be from 4 days to a week. After that, you will be given a new name and situation and moved to a faraway place. Once you have settled down there, we will have to cut off all contact with you for your own safety. I won't be able to see you for a while. Considering my age, I might never be able to see you again. It might have been better if I had never lured you into this troublesome business. I have thought about that many times. Then I would not have had to lose you this way. But..." The dowager's voice caught in her throat. Almame waited quietly for her to continue speaking. "But I have no regrets. Everything was more or less destined to happen. I had to involve you. I had no choice. A very strong force was at work, and that is what has moved me. still. I feel bad for you that it has come to this. On the other hand, we have shared something. Something important. Something we could not have shared with anyone else. Something we could not have had any other way. Yes, you are right, the Dowager said. Sharing it was something that I needed, too. Thank you for saying that. It gives me a measure of salvation. Al-Mame was also pained to think that she could no longer see the Dowager, who was one of the few ties she possessed with the outside world. Be well, Al-Mame said. You too, the Dowager said. And be happy. If possible, Al-Mame said. Happiness was one of the farthest things away from her. Tamado came on the phone.
You haven't used it so far, have you?
He asked.
No, not yet. Try your best not to use it.
I'll keep that in mind. After a momentary pause, Tamado said,
I think I told you the other day that I grew up in an orphanage in the mountains of Hokkaido.
You were put there after you were evacuated from Sakhalin, when you were separated from your parents.
There was a boy in that orphanage 2 years younger than I was. He was mixed, half Japanese, half black. I think his father was a soldier from the American base in Misawa. I don't know about his mother, but she was probably a prostitute or a bar hostess. She abandoned him soon after he was born, and he was put in the orphanage. He was a lot bigger than me, but not very smart. The other kids teased him, of course, mainly because his color was different. You know how that goes.
I guess. I wasn't Japanese either, so it fell to me one way or another to be his protector.
Our situations were similar. A Korean evacuee and the illegitimate mixed-race kid of a black guy and a whore. You can't get much lower than that. But it did me good. It toughened me up. Not him, though. He could never be tough. Left on his own, he would have died for sure. In that place, you had to have a quick wit or be a tough fighter if you wanted to survive.
Al-Mame waited quietly for him to go on.
He was bad at everything. He couldn't do anything right. He couldn't button his own shirt or wipe his ass. Carving, though, was something else. He was great at that. Give him a few carving tools and a block of wood, and before you knew it, he had made a really fine carving. No sketches or anything. The image would pop into his head, and he would produce an accurate three-dimensional figure, tremendously detailed and realistic. He was kind of a genius. It was amazing.
A savant, Al-Mame said.
Yes, sure. I learned about that stuff later, the so-called savant syndrome. People with extraordinary powers. But nobody knew about that back then. People assumed he was mentally retarded or something. A kid with a slow brain, but gifted hands that made him good at carving. For some reason, though, the only thing he would ever carve was rats. He could do those beautifully. They looked alive from every angle. But he never, ever carved anything but rats. Everybody would urge him to carve some other animal, a horse or a bear, and they even took him to the zoo for that purpose. But he never showed the slightest interest in other creatures. So then they just gave up and let him have his way, making nothing but rats. He made rats of every shape and size and pose. It was strange, I guess. By which I mean that there weren't any rats in the orphanage. It was too cold there, and there was nothing for them to eat. The place was too poor even for rats. Nobody could figure out why he was so fixated on rats. Well, anyway, word got out about the rats he was making. The local paper carried a story, and people started asking to buy them. The head of the orphanage, a Catholic priest, got a craft shop to carry the carved rats and sell them to tourists. They must have brought in some decent money. But of course none of it ever came back to the boy. I don't know what they did with it, but I suspect the top people in the orphanage used it for themselves. All the boy ever got was more carving tools and wood to keep making rats in the workshop. True, he was spared the hard field work. All he had to do was carve rats by himself while the rest of us were out. He was lucky to that extent.
What finally happened to him?
I really don't know. I ran away from the orphanage when I was 14 and lived on my own after that. I headed straight for the ferry, crossed over to the main island, and I haven't set foot in Hokkaido since then. The last I saw him, he was bent over a workbench, concentrating on his carving. You couldn't get through to him at those times, so we never even said goodbye. If he's still alive, I imagine he's still carving rats somewhere. It was all he could do.
Almame kept silent and waited for the rest of the story.
I often think of him even now. Life in the orphanage was terrible. They fed us next to nothing, and we were always hungry. The winters were cold, the work was harsh, and the older kids bullied us something awful. But he never seemed to find the life there all that painful. He appeared to be happy as long as he could carve. Sometimes he would go half mad when he picked up his carving tools. But otherwise, he was a truly docile little fellow. He didn't make trouble for anyone, but just kept quietly carving his rats. He'd pick up a block of wood and stare at it for a long time, until he could see what kind of rat in what kind of pose was lurking inside. It took a long while before he could see the figure, but once that happened, all he had to do was pull the rat out of the block with his knives. He often used to say that, "I'm going to pull the rat out." And the rats he pulled out looked as if they might start moving at any moment. He kept on freeing these imaginary rats that were locked up in their blocks of wood.
And you were the boy's protector?
Yes. But not because I wanted to be. I just ended up in that position. And once you were given a position, you had to live up to it, no matter what. That was a rule. Say if one of the other boys took away his carving tools just to be nasty, I would go and beat him up. Even if the other kid was older, or bigger, or there was more than one of them, I had to beat him up. Of course, there were times when they beat me up. Lots of times. But it didn't matter whether I won or lost those fights. I always got the tools back for him. That was the main thing. See what I mean?
I think so, Almame said. But finally you had to abandon him.
Well, I had to go on living. I couldn't stay with him forever taking care of him. I didn't have that luxury, obviously.
Almame opened her right hand again and stared at it. I've seen you holding a little carved rat now and then. Did he make that?
Yes. He gave me a little one. I took it when I ran away. I keep it with me.
You know, Tamaru, you're not the kind of guy who usually talks about himself.
Why now? One thing I wanted to tell you is that I often think of him, Tamaru said. Not that I want to see him again or anything. I really don't. We wouldn't have anything to talk about, for one thing. It's just that I still have this vivid image of him pulling rats out of blocks of wood with total concentration, and that has remained an important mental landscape for me, a reference point. It teaches me something, or tries to. People need things like that to go on living. Mental landscapes that have meaning for them, even if they can't explain them in words. Part of why we live is to come up with explanations for these things. That's what I think.
Are you saying that they're like a basis for us to live?
Maybe so. I have such mental landscapes, too. You'd better handle them with care. I will. I have one more thing to say, and that is that I will do everything I can to protect you. If there's somebody I have to beat up, I'll go out and beat them up. Win or lose, I won't abandon you. Thank you. A few tranquil seconds of silence followed. Don't leave that apartment for a while. Just think of it as a jungle, one step outside your door. Okay? Got it, Almama said. The connection was cut. Hanging up, Almama realized how tightly she had been gripping the receiver. What Tamaru wanted to convey to me was that I'm now an indispensable part of their family. That ties once formed will never be cut, Almama thought. We are bound by artificial blood, so to speak. Almama was grateful to Tamaru for having delivered that message. He must have realized what a painful time this was for Almama. It was precisely because he thought of her as a member of the family that he had begun to share some of his secrets. To think that such a close connection could only be formed through violence was almost too much for Almama to bear. We can only share these deep feelings because of my unique circumstances. I've broken the law, killed several people, and now someone is after me and may even kill me. Would it have been possible to form such a relationship if murder had not been involved? Could we have formed such bonds of trust if I were not an outlaw? I doubt it. She watched the TV news, drinking tea. There were no more reports on the flooding of the Akasaka Mitsuke subway station. Once the water receded the next day and the trains were running normally again, it had become old news. The death of Sakigake's leader was still not public knowledge. Only a handful of people knew about that. Almama imagined the large man's corpse being consumed by the high-temperature incinerator. Tamaru had said that not a single bone would be left. Unrelated to either grace or pain, everything would become smoke and blend into the early autumn sky. Almama could picture the smoke and the sky. There was a report on the disappearance of the 17-year-old girl who wrote the best-selling book Air Chrysalis. Eriko Fukada, or Fuka Eri, as she was known, had been missing for over 2 months. The police had received a search request from her guardian and were carrying on a thorough investigation. But nothing had come to light as yet, the announcer said. The screen showed a stack of copies of Air Chrysalis in a bookstore, and a poster with the photo of the beautiful author hung on the store wall. A young female bookstore clerk was interviewed. The book is still selling like crazy. I bought a copy myself and read it. It's really good, very imaginative. I hope they find out where Fuka Eri is soon. The report said nothing about a relationship between Eriko Fukada and Sakigake. The media were very cautious when religious organizations were involved. In any case, Eriko Fukada was missing. She had been violated by her father when she was 10 years old. They had had ambiguous congress, if Amami was to accept his terminology. Through that act, they had led the little people into him. How did he put it again? That's it. They were perceiver and receiver. Eriko Fukada was the one who perceived, and her father was the one who received. Then the man started to hear special voices. He became the agent of the little people and the founder of the religion called Sakigake. She left the religion after that. Then, as a force against the little people, she teamed up with Tengo and wrote the novella Air Chrysalis, which became a bestseller. Now, for some reason or other, she has disappeared, and the police are looking for her. Meanwhile, last night, using a specially made ice pick, I killed Eriko Fukada's father, leader of the religion called Sakigake. People from the religion transported his corpse from the hotel and secretly disposed of it. Almame could not imagine how Eriko Fukada would deal with the news of her father's death. It was a death that he himself asked for. A painless mercy killing. But the fact is that I used these hands of mine to end the life of a human being. A person's life may be a lonely thing by nature, but it is not isolated. To that life, other lives are linked, and I surely have to bear some responsibility for those as well. Tengo is also deeply involved in these events. The Fukadas, father and daughter, are what bind us together. Perceiver and receiver. Where could Tengo be now and what is he doing? Could he have something to do with the disappearance of Eriko Fukada? Are the two of them still working together? The television news, of course, tells me nothing about Tengo's fate. So far, no one seems to know that he was the actual writer of Air Chrysalis. But I know. It appears that he and I are narrowing the distance between us bit by bit. Circumstances carried us into this world and are bringing us closer together, as though we are being drawn into a great whirlpool. It may be a lethal whirlpool, but leaders suggested that we would never find each other outside such a lethal place, just as violence creates certain kinds of pure relationships. She took a deep breath. Then she reached out toward the Heckler and Koch on the table and assured herself of its hardness. She imagined its muzzle being shoved into her mouth and her finger tightening on the trigger. A large crow suddenly appeared on her balcony, perched on the railing, and let out a number of piercing cries. Almame and the crow observed each other through the glass. The crow moved the big, bright eye on the side of his head, watching Almame's movements in the room. He seemed to understand the significance of the pistol in her hand. Crows were intelligent animals. They knew that this block of steel had great importance. Somehow or other, they knew. The crow spread its wings and flew off as suddenly as it had arrived, apparently having seen what it was supposed to see. Once it was gone, Almame stood up, turned off the television, and sighed, hoping that the crow was not a spy for the little people. Almame practiced her usual stretching on the living room carpet. She worked her muscles to the limit for an hour, passing the time with the appropriate pain. One by one, she summoned up each muscle of her body and subjected it to an intense, detailed interrogation. She had the name, function, and quality of each muscle minutely engraved in her mind, missing none. She sweated profusely, working her lungs and heart to the fullest, and switching the channels of her consciousness. She listened to the flow of the blood in her veins, and received the wordless messages that her heart was issuing. The muscles of her face contorted every which way as she sank her teeth into the messages. Next, she washed the sweat off in the shower. She stepped on the scale to make sure there had been no major change in her weight, confirming in the mirror that the size of her breasts and the shape of her pubic hair had not changed. She scowled immensely. This was her morning ritual. When she finished in the bathroom, she changed into a jersey sportswear top and bottom for easy movement. Then, to kill time, she decided to examine the contents of the apartment again, beginning with the kitchen. The foods and the eating and cooking utensils. She memorized each item and devised a plan for which foods she would prepare and eat in what order. She estimated that, even if she never set foot outside the apartment, she could live here for at least 10 days without going hungry, and she could make it last 2 weeks if she was careful in parceling out the supplies. They had stocked the place with that much food. Then she went through the non-food items. Toilet paper, tissues, laundry detergent rubber gloves. Nothing was missing. The shopping had been done with great care. A woman must have participated in the preparations. Probably an experienced housewife, judging from the obvious care that had been lavished on the task. Someone had meticulously calculated what and how much would be needed for a healthy 30-year-old single woman to live here alone for a short time. This was not something a man could have done, though perhaps it would be possible for a highly observant gay man. The bedroom linen closet was well stocked with sheets, blankets, and spare pillows, all with the smell of new linen and all plain white. Ornamentation had been carefully avoided, there being no need for taste or individuality. The living room had a television, a VCR, and a small stereo with a record player and a cassette deck. On the wall opposite the window, there was a waist-high wooden sideboard. She bent over and opened it to find some 20 books lined up inside. Someone had done their best to assure that Ao Mame would not be bored while hiding out here. The books were all new hardcover volumes that showed no evidence of having been opened. Most of them are recent, probably chosen from displays of current bestsellers at a large bookstore. The person had exercised some standards of selection, if not exactly taste, in choosing about half fiction and half non-fiction. Air Chrysalis was among them. With a little nod, Ao Mame picked it up and sat on the living room sofa in the warm sunshine. It was not a thick book. It was light, and the type was large. She looked at the dust jacket and at the name of the author, Fuka Eri, printed there, balanced the book on her palm to gauge its weight, and read the publisher's copy on the colorful band around the jacket. Then she sniffed the book for that special smell that new books have. Though his name was nowhere printed on it, Tengo's presence was here. The text printed inside it had passed through Tengo's body. She calmed herself and opened to the first page. Her teacup and the Heckler and Koch were both where she could reach them.
Chapter 18. Tengo, that lonely, taciturn satellite. She might be very close by, Fuka Eri said, after some moments of biting her lip in serious thought. Tengo unfolded and refolded his hands on the table, looking into Fuka Eri's eyes. Very close by? You mean here, in Koinji? Within walking distance? How do you know that? Tengo wanted to ask her, but he was at least prescient enough to know that he would not get an answer to such a question. She needed practical questions that could be answered with a simple yes or no. Are you saying that I can meet Ao Mame if I look for her in this neighborhood? Tengo asked. Fuka Eri shook her head. You can't meet her just by walking around. She's within walking distance, but I can't find her just by walking around. Is that what you are saying? Because she's hiding. Hiding? Like a wounded cat. Tengo got an image of Ao Mame curled up under a moldy-smelling porch somewhere. Why? Is she hiding from someone? He asked. This, of course, she did not answer. But the fact that she is hiding must mean that she is in some kind of critical situation, doesn't it? Critical situation, Fuka Eri said, echoing Tengo with a look on her face like that of a child being shown a bitter medicine. She probably didn't like the sound of the words. Like someone is chasing after her, Tengo said. Fuka Eri cocked her head slightly, meaning she didn't understand. But she is not going to stay here forever. Our time is limited. Yes, limited. But now she is sitting somewhere like a wounded cat, so she won't be out taking walks. No, she won't do that, the beautiful young girl said with conviction. In other words, I'd have to look for her someplace special. Fuka Eri nodded. What kind of special place would that be? Tengo asked. Needless to say, he received no answer. You remember some things about her, Fuka Eri said after a short pause. One of them might help.